the truth of London as a place is not contained within London. It's about its relationships to other places.
You have a history of London having access to the global earlobes.
They have this fan base that travels outside of East London, across Europe, North America, and West Africa.
You're listening to Lost and Found. I'm Jonathan Green. Today, we're taking you on a tour of London. But today we're going to see a side of the city that's been carved out from its urban music. Genres like grime, garage, dubstep, drum and bass. Now, urban, I know, is a contested term, overtones of race. But today we're applying it in a spatial sense. Music that uses the sounds of London itself, music found in London's clubs, pirate radio stations, council estates, youth clubs, buses, bedrooms. It's a soundscape that can't be detached from Black Britain. So pop your earbuds in, pop on some comfortable sneakers, I'd suggest. Let's rediscover this shape-shifting global city.
England was principal within the process of colonization. So we have a relationship with Africa and Africans that go back four centuries at least.
That's Michael Riley, a founding member of the Grammy Award-winning British roots reggae band Steel Pulse. He's now a senior lecturer and director of the Black Music Research Institute and principal investigator for bass culture research at the University of Westminster.
Actually, the first contract with Black musician in the UK was with John Blank and Henry VIII, somewhere around 1530 or somewhere around there. And it was recognition by Henry VIII that he really liked this particular trumpeter. And the trumpeter turned around and says, look, mate, you'll have to pay me a proper salary. And he got a contract. But I cite that because London is a global city, and it's one of the few spaces on the planet where creatively you can come together around your activity and meet everyone. Well, everyone is from somewhere different. If we move to the end of the Second World War, England was pretty much, and London in particular, decimated by German bombing. And there was a infrastructure problem, a rebuilding of infrastructure that required labor that was not available in a way that it was. And so there was a call out to the Caribbean. Jamaica was one of the bigger islands, or is the biggest of the islands. There's a direct call to come and support the motherland. And so lots of Caribbeans responded to that call to come and assist in redeveloping, rebuilding Britain. Your love is a light for I realized that so much when I first met you.
It's impossible to imagine what British music, London music, or British music, or any kind of pop music in Britain would be like without the influence of Caribbean migration in particular.
Caspar Melville there, he's a longtime Londoner, a former music journalist and DJ. Now he's a senior lecturer in global creative and cultural industries at SOAS. And just before the pandemic hit, he published the book It's a London Thing, How Rare Groove, Acid House and Jungle Remapped the City.
It's hard to untangle the threads. Obviously, I mean, people who came from the Caribbean came from their own strong musical cultures. You know, Afro-diasporic music tends to have a very strong role, music and dance and carnival and this kind of thing. Partly, I think, because Afro-diasporic cultures are cultures which have been deprived access to other forms of expressive arts. You know, so music is really the art of poor people because you can make music relatively cheaply and easily. But that's not also to say that music hasn't got its own very special role in community life, in emotional life, spiritual life. When Afro-Caribbeans came to London, their first experience, the so-called Windrush generation, so the Windrush docks in 1948, it's got about almost 500 Jamaicans on it. And Jamaica is the place from which the largest group, because it's the largest island in the British Caribbean, what was then the British Caribbean, starts a process by which there's, you know, something in the region of 500,000 people come in the period between 48 and the late 60s, although it continues after that, but the legislation kind of curtails it a little bit. They brought their musical culture with them, and music was a really vital connection to home. The music at that time, we're talking about music very strongly influenced by Black America, by African American musical forms like jump jive and bebop, and you know, and soul music, and country music as well. Jamaicans love country music. When they came to London, or London in particular, you know, 60%, roughly 60% of the Caribbean migration settled in London. They were British citizens. They had British passports, but they were not welcome. They came as workers. They came as you know, proud members of the British Commonwealth in many cases, but they were largely rejected. They found it difficult to find places to live, to find place, you know, they didn't have access to social housing initially. They didn't have access to the job market, and they didn't have access to sort of the arenas of leisure, you know, like the pubs and football and the other kind of zones of British, often working class leisure, because of racism, because of racial exclusion, color bars, a sense that they weren't welcome. And also, of course, migrant populations want to sort of come together to, you know, be reminded of home, to find security and safety. And that tended to happen in the Afro-Caribbean community around music. And a key thing, a key element of this is access to records and record players. And this came kind of in two ways in the UK. One of them was that almost, you know, the typical West Indian household in Britain would have a record player called a Blue Spot, which is one of the earliest gramophones or commercially available gramophones, in their front room, on which they would play records. Often those records would have been brought by hand from the Caribbean, you know, and people who came over would bring records in their luggage. Then there was a postal order service where you could order records from the Caribbean and America. And then there were record shops which sprung up to cater to this market as well. Record stalls, record shops, places like Peckings, which sold Jamaican reggae, and Webster's stall in Shepherd's Bush Market, places like that. And then on the other hand, there was this development of another kind of musical system, the so-called sound system. So what we're talking about here is a huge hi-fi with big speakers, which is for public consumption of music. These have been developed in Kingston in the 40s and 50s. Basically, it's a cheap way to make a nightclub. It's a temporary way of making a nightclub. These were ways for the Afro-Caribbean community to come together outside of the circuits of kind of nightclubs in Soho or you know, local discos, or places where it actually were quite dangerous at this point for Black people to go to, if they could even get in, and set up their own kind of network of musical cultural events. These would happen in town halls, municipal spaces, church halls, people's houses, the so-called blues party, which is a bit like the rent party from in the America, which is, you know, someone would just turn over their flat in a housing estate or their house and put a sound system in it, maybe charge a couple of pounds on the door, which would cover the costs, have food. And these became the most important Afro-Caribbean events, cultural events, social events, but also musical events. And of course, the thing about this culture is, while it was developed by Black British people in the light of racial exclusion, it was partly to do with security and providing an economy, a kind of alternative economy for people to work within, because it was places where people could get jobs as selectors, or people who set up the sound system, or people who carried the boxes, or people who made the food. So it was an alternative kind of economic structure. It wasn't completely closed off to other people, partly because you can't close off the music. You know, when a sound system's playing on your street or down your road, you can tell, you can hear it. And also because while these are being developed in the light of racial exclusion, they are not themselves operating racial exclusion, in the sense that, you know, white people were allowed to go to sound systems, were allowed to participate up to a point. And gradually, with the development of this kind of mixed culture, a multiculture in London in the 70s and 80s, where Black and white people collaborated, you know, people who'd gone to school with each other, lived close by each other, had become friends, would collaborate on developing something out of what was quite a kind of a Black Afro-Caribbean sound system culture, started morphing into something which was more mixed in the 1980s, sort of giving birth to what we understand as, you know, London club culture, which has got a very strong reggae root, but starts incorporating different musical forms, soul and funk and jazz funk in the 70s, and then with the explosion of hip-hop in the 1980s and electronic forms blended with reggae and a kind of reggae sensibility, and often being played on reggae sound systems by the younger brothers and nephews of the big men who ran the reggae sound systems, but who had aspirations to develop a more local, a more British, a more modern, a younger version of that. And at this point, really, it's, I don't know, I can't speak for everyone, but as a young white middle-class boy growing up in London, from the moment that I discovered reggae and the music I experienced and all the other white people I knew was primarily black music. For me, British music became very strongly reggae, ska, two-tone, and then increasingly funk, soul, and all of the genres that subsequently emerged from that after Acid House, you know, dubstep, UK garage, grime. You know, to me, it's part of one whole lineage, all of which, you know, which has its origin in sound system culture.
Enter in the dance, plug it in and we begin. Crowd up in the center, they watch me with him. Watch the way we drop it in a mix time it. Rise and amplify it when we come in with the swing. Just follow the back and naturally harmonize it. Climb into position, we synchronize it. Live from outer ghetto, we maximize it. Sound of the Hoover mother, we super style.
One of the things you'll most often hear anchored in the music that's emerged from London is place. Yes, that amorphous old thing. For younger Londoners making urban music, the hyper-local has been invoked to mark their place, to proudly declare, we are here, to a city which has, at times, turned its back on them. This is the London of inner city council estates, the large brick concrete blocks of flats that rose up in modernist and brutalist skin after the Second World War. In these locales, you'll find some of the most ethnically diverse parts of the city, alongside some of the poorest, wedged next to immense wealth. London's inner eastern boroughs of Tower Hamlets, Newham and Hackney are obvious examples, clustered around the City of London, that centuries-old global financial centre, and Canary Wharf, London's second CBD. Amid these socio-economic and geographic juxtapositions came a new musical form, grime.
Hey. Man's never been in. When it shut down, that's not me and it shut down. Ring, ring, it shut down. Hey. Fashion week and it shut down. Went to the show sitting in the front row in a black tracksuit and it shut down. Touched the road and it shut down. Boy, better know when it shut down. Yeah,
take time if I'm you can't help but hear the history of Black Britain when you listen to a genre like grime.
That's Joy White, sociologist and ethnographer based at the University of Bedfordshire, just out of London. Her 2014 PhD looked at grime and entrepreneurship. And later, she published one of the first books that analysed the socioeconomic significance of the UK urban music economy. Her latest book, Terraformed: Young Black Lives in the Inner City, zooms in on the experience of young black youth in London's inner eastern borough of Newham.
Newham was heavily bombed during the Second World War, and the housing was of poor quality anyway. So the large-scale slum clearance meant that there's this development of social housing, of council estates. At the same time, there was kind of a spatial separation in as much as the south of the borough was very white, wasn't a place that was hospitable in those days to new black residents. And the south of the borough was more accessible. You know, there was slightly less council housing, but there were homes that were available to rent. And so you get this development of different communities living side by side, but young people intermingling, particularly around the council estate, around the blocks, on street corners, in youth centres and so on. And it's in those places where you see and hear the emergence of grime. And when you listen particularly to early grime, you can hear the influences of those communities and musical expression coming together, but making something that's quite new and particular to young people's lives as they're living them in the turn of the 20th century.
Thank you.
Newham is a historically poor borough, but what we find in the last 10 or 15 years is an increasing amount of regeneration, an increasing amount of gentrification. The London 2012 Olympics are a kind of focal point, but the regeneration of Newham begins a few years prior to that and is continuing. And, you know, you can look to the east, you can literally see new developments. You can see the financial district of Canary Wharf. Newham's 5 miles or so from the old City of London, one of the richest financial districts. And so you do have this juxtaposition of great wealth on the doorstep that doesn't quite touch most of the long-standing residents of Newham.
Pick yourself up, don't be lazy, wake up. Make yourself move, life is moving faster now. Watch the way you move, watch the way your paper level goes.
There's high unemployment, particularly among Black youth. The opportunities to be in a job, to earn some money, to be part of the social milieu comes along with having an income. And all of those opportunities are difficult and in many ways impossible. And what the grime music scene allowed many people to do was to not bypass that, but step into new identities as DJs, MCs, entrepreneurs, film producers, and so on, and to break out of those territories that were seen as bordered and enclosed and, yeah, just stuck in some way.
So what's it like to make music in London now? Genres have mutated. As we've seen in other cities, London's musicians have been pushed to the geographic margins as rising rents make the inner city inaccessible for many. But if you pop down to South London, chances are you'll intersect with the work of Bradley Zero. He's best known as the founder of the independent music label Rhythm Section International, whose motto is Peckham Strong, a nod to the label's origins in that South London suburb. Before that, he was primarily a DJ and host on the British online radio station NTS, a role facilitated by a familiar London site, The Sound System.
I don't know if you've ever been to Peckham, but there's quite a famous bar on the roof of a multi-storey car park that is only open in summer. It's called Frank's Campari Bar. But it started off as essentially a sculpture park. There was a big push in the 1980s to regenerate Peckham, you know, to shake off the tired Only Fools and Horses image and make it into a city centre outside of the city centre. But with the big financial crisis that happened back then, everything got put on hold. So they didn't get around to building the shopping centres and regenerating the high streets, but they did build this huge multi-storey concrete car park. So that has basically sat there unused for the last 30 years until a gallery came around and basically asked the council if they could use it, because it was just not being used. So I, being involved in the kind of fine art scene and, you know, working in a bar in the area and starting to DJ a bit and just knowing people, Hannah Barry, who was the gallerist who started the project, asked me to set up the sound system and put it together on the roof of this multi-story car park. And my payment was to keep the mixer that I bought for the show. And it just so happened that the DJs playing on that night were the NTS DJs, and that was maybe the first or second year of them starting. And that's where I met them all. And then I met Femi on the roof. I ordered this huge, huge sound system that got complaints like up to 5 miles away in nearby districts, and just got to know them through that, and then got offered a show, and the rest was history. NTS. When you start anything on a DIY basis, there's not really a grand plan. And there definitely wasn't a grand plan with Rhythm Section. Not to say that there wasn't any ambition, but you make these decisions and you put together a logo and you have a kind of a motif or something like that. And you have no idea how far and wide that will reach. So at the beginning, it wasn't trying to kind of push Peckham outside to anywhere else. It was just about it was for Peckham, you know. We put on a really small party at the beginning in a pool hall. It wasn't glamorous. It wasn't really appealing to, well, it certainly wasn't appealing to anyone outside of London, and it barely appealed to anyone north of the river. You know, it was really a local gathering. And I think the reason behind me wanting to kind of, you know, celebrate that particular area was that it did feel a bit disconnected back then, you know, that what was going on in Peckham wasn't really taken on by the rest of London. And there was a disconnect largely to do with the train lines. You know, I think the geography of a city is often kind of dictated by the transport connections. And for the longest time, Peckham was not connected to the overground. So it sounds petty, but to get from Peckham to Shoreditch 10, 15 years ago took like an hour and a half. So all of the stuff that was going on in Dalston, NTS, Alibi, all the kind of cool East London stuff, as we would have seen it in the day, had nothing to do with us. And it was almost like going on holiday to go over there. So when the overground came and you could get from Peckham to Shoreditch in less than 20 minutes, it really changed it and it opened up the area. In the daytime, it's the markets are on, at least when it's not a lockdown in a pandemic. You know, there's a hustle and bustle. There's a large African community. There's a large Caribbean community. There's an Afghan community. There's Kurdish. All these foods and people are represented on the high street. You know, if you walk down Rye Lane on a Sunday, you're going to hear the churches. You're going to hear the call to prayer coming from the other side of the street, and it's going to be full of people picking up the fruit and veg and everything else. If you come on a Friday, Saturday night in peacetime, it's now a destination, which still blows my mind, because when we moved down here, it's hard to kind of explain and do justice to how much things have changed. Like it was just not a destination. There was no clubs. There was one bar. There was nothing to do for a young person at night. At least for the few years when I first moved here. If you speak to people who lived in Peckham in the 80s and the early 90s, it was a whole different story. And there was quite a lot of things that used to happen. And there were clubs on Rye Lane and there was venues near the park, but all of this disappeared. And it's really in the last 5 to 8 years, it's become like a place to go. So now you step onto Rye Lane on a Friday night and it's a busy, busy cultural meeting point. I think London's multiculturality, is that a word? I think that's the beginning and the core of all of the pioneering sounds and new genres that have popped out of it. It's essentially traced back to the Windrush and all of these influences that came from the Caribbean via Africa and found themselves together in this city that was just ready to kind of chew them up and spit something different out. And the interesting thing that sets it apart from America is that America had all these same cultures arrive, but they'd got there a lot earlier, and then that culture, you know, of African Americans had, you know, was well established by the mid 20th century, and by the end of the 20th century, as we all know, it's pop culture. But in the UK, the people arrived a lot later, but had a different set of ingredients. These things, the elements of the sound system culture, the bass kind of leading the way, I guess a sort of MC culture that is distinct from rapping, which began with reggae and then was developed into garage. And like these things could only have happened in London. It's quite a exciting mix. And I feel that these developments are just continuing to happen and won't really stop anytime soon.
You've been listening to Lost and Found. This week, looking at London's urban soundscapes. For more armchair travel, find Lost and Found on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And for more episodes on music and cities, well, try our South Auckland one or Brixton. You've been listening here to Mikhail Riley, Casper Melville, Joy White and Bradley Zero. Producers are Lisa DeVissi and Alan Weed, and technical production by Tim Simons. I'm Jonathan Green. It's a London thing.